Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource supported by our listeners. To find out how and learn more about our program, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We also thank the Management Learning Journal and the European Group for Organizational Studies for their wonderful support. Now on with the show. Welcome to episode 84, where we are discussing the works of Louis Brandeis, who was a lawyer, management consultant, and U.S. Supreme Court Justice in the early 20th century. Our primary text is a collection of his speeches titled Business, a Profession, published in 1916 and available in the public domain. This is part one of the episode, where we will discuss the many contributions of Brandeis to management science, as expressed in his speeches. To get the text and other associated readings, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com.
So hello, this is Pedro coming to you from Copenhagen.
Hi, this is Michael coming to you from Utrecht in the Netherlands.
And this is Tom calling from Carlisle, Pennsylvania in the United States.
Hi, and I'm Steve, coming to you from Wellington, New Zealand.
And I'm Todd, also coming from Wellington in New Zealand.
Welcome, everyone, and welcome especially to Steve Cummings and Todd Bridgman, who are joining us today for a very special episode on Louis Brandeis. And Steve is a returning podcaster. He was with us in a previous episode. That was, which episode was that? I'm suddenly forgetting.
Well, I think that was, we did an episode on Kurt Lewin.
Right.
Kurt Lewin. And I think Todd was also involved in that. So both Todd and myself have been a part of this great podcast before.
Why don't you go ahead and tell us a little bit more about yourself, especially for those listeners who haven't, who hadn't caught that previous episode. And then we'll get right into the topic.
Sure. Well, my name is Stephen Cummings, and I'm based at Victoria University Wellington here in New Zealand. And together with Todd, we've done a lot of work in the last 10, or maybe even longer now, 15 years on the history of management, taking a critical approach and looking at some of the people and institutions that are seen as foundational. You know, looking again at some of the assumptions that we make about those key individuals and what we regard as the conventional history of management.
Yeah, and I guess just also to that, I have my faculty role here at Victoria University of Wellington, but I'm also co-editor of the SAGE journal, Management Learning, which is critical and reflexive scholarship on organizations. And we're very proud to have a collaboration with this podcast. And so it's really good to be part of it today. Thank you.
Thank you. And we really appreciate the support. It's been a tremendous partnership. So today we're talking about Louis Brandeis, which is one of those figures from the history of management that is often overlooked because he was scientific management, but his focus and his direction was completely different than how management came out over the course of the 21st century. So we're bringing in several of his speeches that have been assembled together in a collection called Business, a Profession, which is also the title of the first speech in this collection. But I mean, we'll refer to several of these speeches during the course of the conversation. But that first one is a very interesting one and just kind of highlights how differently and out of step, I don't know if that's the right way to put it, he was with the rest of management thinking that followed.
Yeah, I think that's a really good summary, Tom. And it is, I think both Todd and myself have found it to be quite remarkable that Brandeis is overlooked. And if you think about the text that we're talking about today, which is, as Tom says, a collection of essays and speeches and articles that Brandeis wrote really at the height of his powers in that period from about the middle of the first decade of the 20th century, from about 1905 through to 1913. And it was a time when he was probably the world's most well-known or most popular management consultant. But back at a time before there were management consultants, he was a lawyer, obviously, and you know, he's most famous for being Supreme Court Justice from 1916 to 1939, and probably the most controversial appointee to the Supreme Court ever. I mean, Brandeis holds the record for the longest nomination period. He was nominated by President Woodrow Wilson in 1916, and it took 4 months for him to be approved. You know, some say because he was Jewish and there was an anti-Semitic view that many people didn't explicitly suggest, but was maybe there in the background. But mostly because he was seen by many people to be anti-business, because he was an advocate who had taken the side of workers' rights, promoted conservation, had promoted social goods. But when he was eventually appointed, he served on the Supreme Court for 23 years. And if you look at any list of the best or the most impactful Supreme Courts, you know, Brandeis is normally in the top 10, so an extremely successful and highly regarded Supreme Court justice. But 1914 is where or when business, a profession, is published. And it's published in the same year as another book that Brandeis wrote, which is called Other People's Money. And Other People's Money was about, you know, informing the American public about what banks do with your money and how they profit from the investment of others. And this was kind of like, this is Brandeis's thing. His idea was that, you know, the American people, working people, should be more informed about business and finance and government and the law and how those things impacted on their daily lives. So, you know, the fact that he published these two books in 1914, you know, it's as if, you know, today, you know, Tom Peters or Elon Musk published two business bestsellers in the same year. So he's tremendously well known, you know, very, very famous at that point in time. And yet he doesn't appear in management history. And so Todd and I thought this was interesting and wanted to explore it. So we're delighted that we're focusing on business, a profession. You know, as you say, Tom, as we go through the discussion today, it'll be great to get into some of those ideas and look at Brandeis's background.
Maybe before we go into the ideas, thanks, Stephen, for putting this into to context. And that immediately probes a question. Like, Brandeis has become like a footnote in management studies and almost like forgotten. So in which way did you come across his work and how did you delve up his ideas on management? Got you on this track on writing a book about his work?
You're absolutely right, Michael. I mean, I think it is surprising that Brandeis has become a footnote. I mean, surprising in one way, but I suppose not surprising in another way when we think about history. Because when we look at history, we tend to take a person or an institution's fame, if you like, or notoriety in the present, and then look backwards to try and figure out how did they get to have this notoriety or this fame. And of course, you know, when you become a Supreme Court justice in the United States, and when you're the first Jewish Supreme Court justice and you know, and a reformer like Brandeis was, that's kind of the way that we've looked back at him. You know, we've looked back to sort of figure out, well, how did he become a Supreme Court justice? And so we've tended to look very much at his legal achievements. But of course, in addition to that, he was also a business advisor and an advocate for social reform. But we tend to overlook that because we focus on the legal side of things. But Todd and I first came across Brandeis when we were looking into the history of management more generally, and, you know, looking at Frederick Taylor and where Taylor's ideas came from. And of course, you know, every management student who studies Management 101 knows Frederick Taylor, and he's regarded as the father of management. He's regarded as the father of management because he invented an approach called scientific management. And when Todd and I looked into that and where it came from, we realized that Taylor didn't invent scientific management. Scientific management was something invented by Brandeis as a collection of ideas which encompassed a lot of different management thinking at the time. Taylor was obviously a big part of that. But Taylor himself did not like the term scientific management. He resisted initially working with Brandeis. He didn't think that Brandeis's terming of the field as scientific management was particularly useful. And Taylor only came into the fold later. So we thought that was interesting. This was back in probably about 10 years ago when we started working on a book called A New History of Management. And of course, that had a very broad scope, that book. So in a way, Brandeis in that book was still a little bit of a footnote. It was an interesting thing that happened along the way. But the more that we thought about it and the more we looked at Brandeis, you know, we came to this view that actually there's a lot more here. You know, Brandeis should be given much more regard. And what we thought was really interesting, I think this is something that probably runs through all of Todd and my work. We thought it wasn't just interesting what Brandeis did in the past. We thought that he had some insights that would be really useful for how we think about management today in the future. And management history had kind of done those insights a disservice by overlooking them. So that's how we started to think we needed to explore Brandeis a bit further. We could see the connection between sustainable management today, because the ideas that we talk about and appear in management textbooks now is the latest new thing in management, this focus on sustainability, social goods, environmental goods. These were exactly the things that Brandeis thought was the point of good management. These things should be the measure of good management. And yet we have forgotten about them. So we thought that this was worth exploring further. And that's where the book, The Past, Present, and Future of Sustainable Management came from. That's my interpretation. Anyway, Todd might have some other ideas about how we sort of started to explore this world of the first decade of the 20th century in the United States.
Yeah, well, I guess maybe just a more general point that Steve's touched on to connect to the work that we've done. We're interested in this distinction between the past and history, and the way we understand that is, you know, the past is events that have happened previously, but history is a narrative of those past events. And you know, the view of history as being therefore necessarily subjective, that decisions are made by people who are writing history about what events from the past to include and which to exclude, which people from the past to include and which to exclude. You know, this makes it a necessarily subjective interpretation of events that have gone previously. So part of what we've tried to do is to uncover people and events such as Brandeis's contribution to management that we think have been forgotten by history, and make an argument why we might want to create a new history of management. So this, the letter A is very important there. We're not making the argument to create the new history of management. So recognizing the plurality of possibilities of thinking about the past is very important to us. And so, you know, wanting to recover Brandeis's contribution. But also, and this is, I think, makes the work important beyond him, is to think about why he has been forgotten by history. So not just a recovery and thinking about the value for today, but really, I guess, the politics of knowledge, the politics of knowledge about the creation of this field, management studies, and why is it that management studies remembers certain people and promotes certain values and ideas, but has been reluctant to remember others who might have different ways of thinking about business and management.
This is very interesting, right? And I was thinking that maybe before we get into the process through which such ideas were forgotten and the reasons why, and you're already starting to bring that up towards the politics that are embedded in knowledge production, it would be helpful to try to think of what are the key ideas from Brandeis, or how at least we would make sense of them with the lenses we have today, right? And I was thinking in particular of the first text, The Business of Profession, right? The opening speech that he gave as a commencement speech for the Brown University, I think, right? And when I read that, I think some striking features is that, as you both already said, there is an idea that social good matters for business, and more in particular, that profit is not an end in itself, but a means for something, right? But I think was also curious the way he was trying to argue for that with the notion of professionalization, which is a bit different from what we see it today in light of, you know, how we study professions and the idea of what is a profession or not. But it seems that the key argument seems to be that it's about promoting and working for the pursuit of greater good beyond one's own objectives and one's stance, And there is also an idea of vocation, right? Because it tries to insist that should something that someone should pursue, not just but the by the individual dividends you can get, but also by the idea that you're working towards something bigger than oneself, right? And it was very interesting to think of that in light of Brandeis' own background as a lawyer, right? And as a civil servant, because somehow I see some of that in those ideas, which seems to be an idea of business as necessarily embedded, as administration as something that is for a purpose that's bigger than the techniques that exist, you know, in trying to interrogate what we do with them, right? But I was curious if that was how this interpretation was shared by the others. Like, you know, did you all see something different? Is there anything else that we should include on these overall ideas of the core ideas of Brandeis?
I know I was struck by the professionalization aspect of it. I mean, obviously, the whole text of the speech is, or the purpose behind the speech was to promote the idea that business is a profession or should be a profession, and that the profession, as I'm quoting here from the text, an occupation pursued largely for others and not merely for oneself, and an occupation in which the amount of financial return is not the accepted measure of success, and goes through to talk about the idea of how business should be promoting the good of the customer, I mean, or the customer and the worker. It should be oriented in that particular way. That was very surprising, because, of course, as we know, Taylorism, the myth, really is the opposite of that. What we hear the word Taylorism, the thing that jumps to mind is the complete opposite of that.
Yeah, no, I think Pedro and Tom, that those are really, really good points. And I think for Todd and myself, this speech, I think, is the best way into Brandeis's thinking, because it really does give this really nice overview. I mean, he's basically providing, you know, young people, students at Brown University, which is an Ivy League college in Rhode Island, he's presenting this vision of why they should choose to become business people. But the reasons that he's outlining for doing that seem, on the one hand, so modern. I mean, it's the kind of speech that we might imagine an enlightened philanthropist, social do-gooder, you know, business leader today might give in 2021. And at the same time, it seems so opposite from what we think management and business was about in that period at the beginning of the 20th century. And as Tom says, it seems so far away from Taylorism. So there's a couple of things there. I mean, one is that it's actually not that far away from Frederick Taylor himself. I mean, if you go back and you read the Principles of Scientific Management and those first few pages, which nobody reads that book anymore, even though we all see it as a foundation. You know, he says, you know, Taylor himself says this is part of the conservation movement. This is about using resources in an equitable and sustainable way. And it's really interesting, you know, when Todd and I were on a call the other day with some people from China, you know, part of a big organization in China that were interested in the work. And of course, in places like China and Russia and France, and even Britain to some extent, Taylor has a very different reputation. You know, in places, people in China found it hard to understand, you know, why did workers not like Taylor? Because for us, what Taylor is trying to do is to create more equity and get managers and workers, you know, not in this hierarchy, but working together. So coming back to Todd's point, it's a lot about how we record and remember ideas. But so Taylor's not as far away from Brandeis in reality as what we think. But yeah, but Brandeis does take it next level in terms of the sorts of things he's outlining. You know, he's outlining a vision of business for these young Ivy League students to say, you know, that there's another profession out there. It's not just being a doctor or a lawyer or an architect. I mean, business is a worthy profession as well. And it's as Tom was saying, you know, his outline of what a profession is seems so different from what we've come to believe that business generally should be about. You know, it's a profession because it's intellectual in nature. It's a profession because it's pursued for the good of others, not for oneself. It's a profession because financial return is not the accepted measure. I mean, really, is financial return not the accepted measure of business at this point in history? That I think that was for us, for Todd and myself, I think what was really surprising, because it on the one hand seems so modern and it seems so different from what we had been taught about Taylorism, but we could dive in more to some of the details about that essay.
Oh, absolutely. And I do want to mention that we did an episode on Andrew Abbott's System of Professions. And if you want to talk about a very, very different look at professions as more of a competitive system as opposed to, say, an altruistic system, that's a good episode to highlight.
Yeah, no, following up on that, Tom, in a way, I mean, what Brandeis is in this speech, of course, it's directed to students, but to me, it's also that he seems to speak to business leaders themselves as well, through later publishing his text and also in other speeches, he addresses them directly. And it's not only a perspective on business as a profession. I would also say it's very much a clear strategy of getting students and also business leaders in his camp on conservative management or management for conservation and what we can now call sustainable management. Because he's also, I mean, there are these major cases that he's known for that he had to deal with and got a lot of pushback from business leader. But he also kind of tries to make it a more of an arena and get some business leaders within his camp. And so that's a bit more of the public perspective, a political perspective on looking at professions, I would say.
Well, certainly, let's go ahead and dive into some of these some of the cases, because this throughout this book, throughout this text, there are all sorts of examples that he gives that sort of back up what he's promoting. So. We talk about some of them.
Yeah, absolutely, Tom. I mean, it's again, you know, it's interesting what people gravitate towards. You know, Todd and I have just been in another discussion with the editors at Sloan Management Review, and a good friend and colleague of ours had sort of promoted our work to MIT Sloan. You know, they're pretty lukewarm about it. They thought, well, okay, Brandeis, it's a long time ago. Doesn't really seem that interesting. You know, can you give us some examples of actual companies that he worked with? What did he do as a management consultant? And I think for Todd and I, penny dropped. I think, oh, okay, not everybody's interested in management history. People want to know, well, what did he do as a consultant? And of course, in that first essay, Business a Profession, when he gives this commencement speech, he focuses on two particular cases. It's kind of like it's a humble brag from 100 years ago. He mentions these two good practice cases of good management, but he doesn't actually mention that he was the advisor that advised these companies to do these things that he now promotes as best practice or good practice. And one of them is a shoe manufacturer, McIlwain's, and the other is Filene's department store. And when we mentioned this to the people at MIT Sloan, they got excited. They said, oh, Filene's. I remember Filene's, you know, the great traditional department store in Boston. You know, what did Brandeis say about Filene's? And that was the hook that got people interested. And I mean, as a commencement speech, it's really well structured. He outlines, look, you know, business is a profession that you as students, and I think also as Michael says, that the world in general should take seriously as a career choice because it is a way to do good and have impact in the world. So he lays that out, and then he provides these two case studies. You know, it's a really well structured speech. And you know, the first case study is about McIlwain's, you know, a shoe manufacturer at the time, biggest shoe manufacturer, I think, in the United States. And Brandeis talks about how McIlwain had this problem. Which McIlwain himself didn't realize, and the unions couldn't quite put their finger on it. And so Brandeis, as he often did, sort of put himself in this middle position between management and unions and wondered if he could find a middle ground. And the problem was that effectively the people who worked in the McIlwain factories They were gig workers, what we today call gig workers. They were brought in when there were shoes to make, but when there weren't shoes to make, they sat at home, you know, unable to make their rent payments, their insurance payments, and, you know, and so they drifted around. And so McIlwain had difficulties with this regularity of employment. And so Brandeis lays out how, you know, if you thought about this scientifically, surely through good marketing and good supply chain management and thinking through how you could regularize production and therefore regularize employment, you'd have staff who were much more engaged. They were getting a fairer deal because I think he outlines that at the end of the process, rather than sort of maybe having 200 days of work a year, staff could rely on 300 days. And that meant everything. You know, at that point in time, you know, there wasn't much of a social safety net. So if you wanted insurance, you needed to make regular payments. Otherwise, your insurance was void. So Brandeis talks about how McIlwain moved from this sort of gig economy through scientific management to ensuring regular employment, something that the unions said, yes, actually, this is a problem, and something that Brandeis gives William McIlwain credit for actually taking on board that idea. So that's McIlwain. So we can, I don't know whether you want to stop and talk a little bit more about McIlwain's before we move on to Filene's, Tom.
No, let's go ahead and go on to Filene, and then, because there's some themes between the two that are pretty constant.
Sure. I think that'll... Okay, well, just to finish off then, talking about Filene's, which is the second case study, very famous and at the time, and actually right through until quite recently, very innovative department store, one of the world's leading department stores owned by the Filene brothers. And Brandeis talks there about how, you know, Filene's is a great example of good management as a profession. Because financial return is not the accepted measure. It's pursued for the good of others, and it's an intellectual pursuit. And so Filene's really thought about how to engage workers, and they created something called the Filene Cooperative Association, which was run by staff, and staff had, if you like, democratic control of the decisions that the corporation company made. And, it's very interesting. One of the things that we contrast in the past, present, our future of sustainable management, as we look at some examples that appear in textbooks about what a great sustainable company Google is. If you pick up a textbook and you might be told that Google and Apple and Amazon, they're these amazing companies that are doing really great things. They're giving people bonuses to buy electric vehicles or, you know, time to sort of to socialize at work. But the Filene Cooperative Association puts all of those to shame. I mean, in the eighth floor, I think it's the seventh floor of the Filene's building, it's completely turned over to staff. They run social clubs. There's a library. There are public lectures. And everything is sort of focused on how can we enable staff to work effectively and efficiently so they have more leisure time to become more educated, to progress in the world. So Brandeis talks about how Filene's have created this system of employee engagement. He also talks a little bit about supply chain management, where he talks about, you know, Filene's supply chain is what we would call an ethical supply chain. So when you went into Filene's, you knew that staff were being treated fairly. You knew that the people who manufactured the goods were being treated fairly. And so therefore, when you purchased products, you could feel good about that supply chain. So again, I mean, it all to us, these sound like really modern examples from a time that we thought was an extremely grim, mechanized, brutal period of, which of course in many respects and many industries it was. But I think this is, you know, come back to Todd's point about, well, why don't we talk about Brandeis? I think one of the reasons might be that the case studies that Brandeis focused on seem more modern than the modern case studies that we have today. You know, they put the Googles and the Apples and the Amazons to shame in terms of their sustainable management practices, which is a, you know, it's an inconvenient truth, if you like, as we think about, or we like to think of history as we're evolving and we're progressing. Management now is way better than what it was in those dark old days. But, you know, if you read that commencement speech, that those days don't seem as dark as what we've come to believe.
So thank you. That's very interesting. And thinking about the two cases when I was reading and listening to you, Stephen, I almost felt that they help us think through the potentiality of scientific management, right, versus what has it become. Because in a way, the first case, it's very much about dealing with optimizing and dealing with administrative problems in a way, right? The issue of the regularity of work and the, you know, Brenda also talks about the issue of punctuality on the delivery that existed. So it's very much about optimizing and get the machinery to work in a more efficient way, in a better way, in a more, you know, improve the administration. Whereas in the second, we see this other layer, which is the purpose for which this organization is run, right? So not only getting to more optimized type of goals, but also having a system of checks and balances that allows to cultivate the voice of employees, that allows to get the voice of the employees to lead in particular directions that it go beyond one would expect, right? And in thinking of these two sides, or at least two layers, right? The optimization that bring that scientific management brings, and also these different checks and balances and systems that allow for the participation of employees. And in the way we can think of Taylor, that already exists, right? And I think that is interesting to pause for a second and reflect on how the way, as you said before as well, on how Frederick Taylor versus Taylorism are different things. And what we see is that in principle, and that was actually the first episode we did here in the podcast, both ideas coexist with Taylor, right? That was an interest in trying to improve and deal and, you know, improve the production. He was an engineer, right? But also with a concern that that would lead to greater welfare for all workers included. And of course, we know that what's happening in manufacturers around the world was very different from that, but that was already implicit. That was what he was trying to get at. And I think there is work of, for example, Paul Adler that tries to shine a light on this ambivalent nature that exists in scientific management, right? On how at the same time it has brought these advances of the improvement of the way manufacturing works, right? And that has been positive. And in principle, it can also lead to more cooperation. It can lead for a better system of work. But in the way that has been implemented, there has been a complete, sometimes, gap between these ideas from Taylor and what comes to exist, which is based on de-skilling and all the sort of stuff that the textbooks are filled with and tell us.
Okay, I think just in relation to Pedro's comment, that the key word in the text for B is efficiency. And, you know, when I've always taught scientific management to my undergraduates for many years, you teach that scientific management is about maximizing efficiency. And the implicit definition is, I think for me, Pedro, is the optimization, using resources in the best way possible. But when I read this text from Brandeis, I see that efficiency has a completely different meaning to the one that we commonly associate it with it today, and a much broader definition to include, you know, the things that you've mentioned. And two striking other points for me, you know, industrial democracy and social justice are implicit in his definition of efficiency. But when I've read management textbooks and until recently taught management to students, industrial democracy and social justice have not been part of the understanding of efficiency. And I know, going back to Steve and his PhD work, he's done some really fascinating work into this understanding of efficiency and how it, the meaning of it came to change and to be understood differently than what Brandeis is talking about today. So I wonder, Steve, if you want to talk a little bit about that.
Todd's right. This notion of efficiency, what it means and where it is in our thinking is really key, because, you know, one of the things that we do, Todd and I do in the book, is we look at how, you know, efficiency didn't have the meaning that we associate it with now, this idea of efficiency being a ratio of outputs over inputs. And the idea in modern management, the conventional view, is that the purpose, that's what defines management as its fundamental purpose, to make more from less, and then to make more and more and more, to create the surplus of financial goods. And then it's like management doesn't comment any further. That's it. So long as you're being more and more efficient, you're making more and more money, you're doing a good job. But for people like Brandeis, you know, being efficient in that way was really, it could only ever be a means to an end. In management today, it's sort of become the end. It's the purpose. It's how we measure good management. But for Brandeis and others, and Taylor as well, to a degree, although I think, again, Taylor didn't really delve into the kind of the greater goods, if you like, social, environmental, to the same extent. But for Brandeis, you know, that was the reason we do this. Michael mentioned before about some of Brandeis's famous legal cases. They were about putting boundaries and controls on big business and how they could utilize workers. You know, probably his most famous case, Mueller versus the state of Oregon, was an argument about whether this laundry owner, Mueller, could make his workforce, which was primarily female, work longer than 10 hours a day. And Mueller's argument was, well, the women seem to want to do this, so it's a free country. I cannot be constrained in this way. And Brandeis is sort of organized this legal argument, sort of the first of its kind, came to be known as the Brandeis Brief, where he didn't just argue legal precedent. He looked at all this new social science, biological science data that was coming out about what were the harmful effects of people working those long hours. And so he organized this amazing brief, 113 pages long, only 2 pages on legal precedent, but 111 pages on social science and biological and behavioral science, you know, new fields, arguing why it was detrimental for people to work and work and work, because they couldn't better themselves as citizens, because there were intellectual and mental illness that would come from that. There were physical illnesses. So for Brandeis and others, you know, we try and be more efficient so we can have more time to live better lives and be better citizens. And this is, I guess, Pedro's point. At some point, there was a fork in the road, a divergence where, no, we work harder and harder so we can earn more money. So we work harder and harder again, and we sort of have this hamster wheel. And I think that's how Taylorism sort of came to be used. And I guess the key difference between Taylor and Brandeis and what Taylorism then became in the Western world, the key difference was, well, who's controlling it? For Brandeis and for Taylor, to a lesser degree, that control should be democratic. It should be shared by workers and management. It should be a discussion that, you know, one man, one woman, one vote to sort of develop the best way forward. But once control was taken by the owners of capital and managers once that control was in the hands of the people at the top, if you like, then scientific management became something very different. And we've ended up in this situation where, you know, we all work so hard we can't disconnect from work, and the purpose of working harder seems to be that we can work harder again, rather than the purpose of working smarter is that we have more time, we have more energy, we have more resources to, you know, as Taylor said, you know, he was a big advocate for spending time in nature, or, you know, physical exercise or mental exercise, further study and those sorts of things. And for him and for Taylor, to a lesser extent, that was the point. So this divergence is a really interesting point that happens between Brandeis and Taylor as they were, and what Taylorism and scientific management becomes.
Yeah, I think that's what I really like about his the text and his view on people being this real positive perspective on human beings, and integrating this whole idea of social justice and industrial democracy within his perspective on management. And in a way, and I'm glad that Pedro mentioned the first episode of this podcast series as well, because actually, we mentioned Brandeis there in the first 2 minutes of the episode. But of course, it was a footnote there. I'm glad we're going into it much more broader here. And but one of the aspects that was discussed in that first episode was that within the principles of scientific management, there is this idea of the worker as a lazy person. And that's totally not Brandeis's message. This is really positive. It's really having best of things with people and putting them on a stage not only provides them with more wealth and power and a position within the organization, but also the organization as a whole And I think that's a difference between Taylor and Brandeis.
Yeah, just on that, it's a really good point, Mike. I think that you can see the difference in the case studies. You know, we've talked about Filene's and McIlwain's, which really are about intellectual pursuits. I mean, that's what a profession is, Brandeis says. You know, these people and the people that work with them have really thought about things. You know, how can we organize work better so that people have more time and more energy and feel better and can contribute more to the organization, but also to society and their own families and their own lives? And you contrast those cases with the case that's most commonly associated with Taylor, which is the kind of infamous case of Schmidt. You know, then there's this sort of lazy racist kind of portrayal of this. He comes across as inarticulate and not very smart, but he's this big, muscular man who Taylor teaches to shovel pig iron more efficiently and effectively. And I think that that whole story of Schmidt, which, I mean, Todd, this is more Todd's area than me, but I think to some degree that the whole story of Schmidt is a bit of a myth. But, you know, people pick up on that and they think, oh, so this is what Taylorism is about. It's about a sort of smug manager treating these stupid workers in ways that, despite themselves, they can become more efficient. Whereas I think you're right, Michael, for Brandeis, you know, it was workers can be more efficient despite management. So the blame is shared. We all have this creative, you know, intellectual capacity. But if we work together, you know, we can find better ways. Whereas for Taylor, partly because of the examples that he focuses on, it does give you a much more negative view of human nature. Maybe Todd, I mean, Todd knows more about Taylor and that pig iron story. I don't know if he wants to talk about that.
Yeah, I do see differences between Brandeis and Taylor. You know, for me, it feels like Taylor was very much focused on what Pedro's described as optimization of the task, the division of labor, the time and motion studies. And it feels like Brandeis has taken that as part of a broader political project for him about, you know, the things we've discussed, developing a better citizen, social justice, industrial democracy. And so it's, for me, Taylor is a subset of this broader idea about society and politics. And what's so sad for me is that management studies has only remembered Taylor and, you know, the optimization of the task and forgotten what I would argue is a politics that is the antithesis of what management studies as an ideological project has wanted to promote over so many years, but which I think is, and maybe we can talk about this later, has become a failed project if we look at, you know, the crises that we're facing today. I just see Brandeis's political work as being so relevant and therefore this desperate need to remember it and, you know, to teach it as where management studies began and what management studies is really about, rather than just this narrow borrowing of efficiency and optimization.
Maybe we can maybe put that into that sort of the Brandeis's broader project, which probably will help us talk about some of the other parts of the book that we're focusing on as well. That might be something we can work our way into.
Yeah, I was going to take us straight to a couple of other the speeches we read, in particular, The Road to Social Efficiency, which is, I think it's like the sixth speech. And this is one that I really keyed in on because it kind of presents his big strategic approach. I mean, it thinking about not just the individual individual laborers, but the whole system of labor. And it's interesting that he begins it with a statement from former President Grover Cleveland. "It is the duty of the citizen to support the government, not of the government to support the citizen," is only qualified true. So what he does is he sets this whole stage, not just in terms of, you know, okay, the relationship between the worker and the company, but sets it in a broader political context where he's talking about the responsibilities of the whole system of government, of private business, private enterprise, whatever. What is their, you know, essentially the social contract with the people? And I think social contract is a good way of putting it, because then this is where he starts getting into, he got into the case study of the life insurance and what the quandary that an unfair system puts the workers in terms of what you were saying before about Steve, about the if they can't get a regular paycheck, that means that they can't get life insurance. So he makes the case that that is socially inefficient, and therefore the aim is to go ahead and develop or build these systems or build relationships among, you know, how do we take care of the worker and therefore how what the worker can contribute to society so that the efficiency is measured in everyone's stability, the stability of the situation, of the work situation, the reliability that they can find work, that they can seek what they want or be able to develop themselves. And that they, you know, it's like efficiency is freedom from worry, because worry becomes waste.
Yeah, it's great now. We've talked about that first commencement speech, Business a Profession, which is the first chapter of the book. And then the subsequent chapters are a greatest hits catalogue of some of the things that Brandeis has done in the lead up to that view of business as a profession. I think it might be quite good just to go a little bit into the whole, you know, Brandeis's advocacy for a new way of providing people with insurance. Because I think this is where Brandeis first kind of emerges on the national stage. And that's what connects him to the work of Theodore Roosevelt and Gifford Pinchot, who are the kind of the advocates for this new way of thinking about industrial development, which has conservation of resources at its core. So you've got kind of Brandeis, this legal advocate, this advisor to business who's interested in social justice. And then you've got Pinchot and Roosevelt trying to develop what they call the conservation movement, which is an alternative way of looking at business from the Gilded Ages, explore and exploit for financial gain, and it's a free country and we can do whatever we want. There shouldn't be any barriers or limits on that expansion. So so what Brandeis finds is that in Boston, where he's working, you know, many people get themselves into a sort of a destitute state through the practices of people who come door-to-door knocking, offering services like life insurance, for example. And obviously people need insurance because it's a fairly perilous time. But the way that life insurance is set up, it's run by individual speculators, really, who employ these armies of door-to-door salesmen to go knocking to sort of sell the benefits of this life insurance. But in the fine print is that you are insured up until the point that you missed a payment. And if you miss a payment, then it's over. We've got your money. We're very sorry, but you missed a payment, so no life insurance for you. And in a world where the work is so sporadic, which is Tom saying, you know, Taylor calls this inefficient because it's wasteful and people worry and they become transient and all sorts of things. So Taylor, Brandeis sees this as a real problem, and he begins. It's probably what he sees as his finest piece of advocacy, where he manages to convince the government and savings banks, because he sees these as a much more reliable institutions that can be regulated to provide life insurance. And because they have the capital behind them, they can structure life insurance in such a way that, okay, if you miss a payment, if you miss a second payment, your policy still stands, but we'll talk to you about how we can, you know, we can ensure that you stay on our books. And for the savings banks, even though they couldn't see it at the time, this was an amazing financial opportunity for them, because all of a sudden, people who didn't save with savings banks now have a relationship through their insurance policy. And so savings banks, you know, they saw that the business benefits of this. And governments, once, I think Brandeis surprised people, because the speculators who were in the insurance game never thought, they thought that their lobbying with government would ensure that this would never pass, this idea that savings banks could provide insurance. It would never get through, would never be approved. But Brandeis, and this is the nature of how he works, he seems to be very skillful at this behind the scenes. This is a good opportunity for you. This is a good thing for citizens. This will make you more popular as a politician. So he manages to reform life insurance in the United States, which, you know, on the surface, because we take it for granted now, doesn't seem like such a big deal. But you know, it's really important for working people to have that security, because if they have that security, they worry less and they can be more efficient contributors to communities and societies.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. If so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch via Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Finally, we would like to thank some wonderful people for supporting the show. Sarah Audner, Leon Prieto, Hadi Shaheen, Marshall Reiner, Alice Barbosa, Thomas Roulet, Heiko Schmidt, Barton Friedland, Guldem Kara Mustafa, Roberto Bernardi, Marina Timmer, Bernard Hogan, Eddie Hunziker, Fiona Knight, Peaks Craft, Timothy Paul, Willy Leidon-Wirte, Gabriel Van Bunnen, and Clara Lux. It's easy to support the show, and all you have to do is go to our website, where a donations button will greet you. Thank you for listening, and we hope to see you for the conclusion of this episode here on Talking About Organizations.